Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of State of Our Nation. Now, on top of everyone's mind this morning is the war in Ukraine and its ripple effects that this geopolitical tension would have on countries like Barbados. Obviously, we are now coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, and during that pandemic, we would have suffered some significant economic repercussions. And we are now trying to rebuild. However, this war has come upon us and it is bound to have some impact. We already saw some of it in terms of rising gas prices only this week. But the issues go further than just petrol and petroleum products. Obviously, the Ukraine and Russia do significant agricultural imports. As a matter of fact, I think in terms of grain, corn, wheat, both the countries account for a fifth of the world's exports. And in terms of sunflower, which would make sunflower oil, you're talking about 80% of the world's exports as well. Now, this obviously has implications for other things. I mean, beverages, you're talking fertilizers, you're talking feed as well for animal feed. Now, here with me this morning to try to unpack all of this is economist Jeremy Stevens. These days, I know he doesn't like to be, he wants to be referred to in his new vocation, but I think we all always think about him as economists with some of the best predictions that we have had thus far. Welcome, Jeremy, and thanks for joining us on State of Our Nation.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Jeremy, this Ukraine issue, from an economic perspective, break it down for those persons who really don't quite grasp what the impact is going to be for us.
Okay. Well, it's rather complex. And on scouring Facebook, I noticed here a lot of people really don't get the interconnectivity of the state of play, meaning they just really don't understand how a war with a country like Ukraine, country that many Bajans clearly don't have familiarity with, could really affect, to begin with, the price of oil, but down the line, obviously, it could negatively affect the price in a number of commodities that you laid out clearly there in the preamble. Let's put it this way. The world, let's just start with oil. Fundamentally, the oil markets are made up of cartels, and that term is a rough term, but in economics it's used. Pretty much it just means that there's a group of countries, you know, membership ranges up to 13, some people say up to 26, and so the ancillary members. And they pretty much price together and they decide what quantities of oil they're going to put out there into the market. And they all are politically motivated because it's country run. And it's all run based on specific political objectives that benefit the group, firstly. And because they are the leading oil producing nations, profitability is a secondary objective. And this is something people don't understand. Further to that, then you have the likes of investment bankers, commodities traders. Those guys would be purchasing oil way down in the future, using futures and other derivatives. Oil derivatives, and mainly those being in futures and then some oil contracts for future delivery of oil, 90 days, 6 months into the future. Now, what does all this mean? When you have countries operating off of political objectives for a resource, number one, that is very much heterogeneous, in other words, it's the same thing no matter what. The only difference is the additives that are added in natural gas and oil as part of the refinement process. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you have those traders, and they react off of moves, off of hype. And these guys are the persons that are buying the oil from the same cartels. The cartel is motivated politically, primarily. And the oil traders are motivated by obviously trying to make a profit, but by anticipating the likely future price that the cartel is willing to, that main cartel, OPEC, is willing to sell oil at, because they pretty much control the world's price. It goes big. Now, what does that mean for us? We don't directly buy oil from countries. We buy oil from refiners. Refiners purchase oil primarily from those countries, or from countries either on licenses or just through the international markets. So it means that that price filter is true. Now, some would argue at this point, it doesn't make sense because Trinidad and Tobago is where we get most of our natural gas from. And I would say, you know, Trinidad and Tobago is a small player, and they're not going to be, they're going to be a price taker. And it makes sense because they don't want that, for argument's sake, their price too low, and then they can't supply the demand that will come about as a result of the price dropping too low. So they will always be somehow in line, and it's in their, to their benefit, to help manage their reserves here and to extract as much profitability at each point in time. So Trinidad and Tobago have, and being a close neighbor to Venezuela as well, has that effect. But Trinidad and Tobago will price in line. Jamaica will price in line. You know, any of these small players that we buy from will price in line. But they would also, because Barbados is small as well, price higher than what the global barrel, price per barrel is for oil. And the cubic, I don't remember the unit right now for some reason, of natural gas that's being sold on the global market. So already Barbados buys at a premium to begin with. And because we're so small and we order a very small amount on a weekly basis of natural gas, refined natural gas, you know, we will continue to pay a premium above the global market. So that's where the shock comes through, before government taxation and governments, let's say, slight hesitancy to use derivative contracts to control the price of oil. They could do the same as these bigger global traders would, but economically or financially, it may not make much sense, because they might not be able to buy enough contracts to make it worth the while to pay for those contracts. Think of the contracts as an insurance policy. You know, the guy who can afford life insurance that is younger and wealthier might be able to get it at a slightly lower premium if you had to do it per month than somebody who's older and doesn't have as many years available to them. So think of the years as being the capital, in other words, right? That you can in this policy. So Barbados has a lot of what I would call headwind issues that pretty much are going to air themselves low. And that, I mean, before we even talk about government's own distortion by excuse me, the rural tax, by a different levies that they apply. I mean, it's been well known since the days of Point Alpha that government introduces a lot of distortion at the pump because of the inelasticity of demand for fuel. In other words, even though the price has gone up for the first time in Barbados that I can recall, at least as an adult, about $4 a liter, $4.13 or so to be exact, as it stands today. You can argue that it is clear that demand for fuel will not drop off as significantly as one would think. People will probably drive a little bit less, but given what I've seen in the gas stations that I've gone about, this is early days yet, I don't expect long term that people are going to say, well, look, I'm going to sell my car and take bus. I'm going to sell my car and pool with a friend. It hasn't gotten to that point just yet. I actually don't know what that breaking point would be. I want to think it would be $4.50, right? A liter. I don't even know if that's the case now. So government well knew for a long time that the only product that it was in control of that stage as well, one of two products really. The other one is road use. Believe it or not, Barbadians would demand less of if the price had to go up, was simply fuel. So for a long time, and that's at the pump. And so for a long time, the government has introduced taxes and removed taxes willy-nilly based on political reasons, first and foremost, and then fiscal reasons, in my opinion, secondarily.
But so, Jeremy, not to cut you across here, but let me just interject quickly. The current levies on fuel, I mean, is at this stage, does it make sense at this point to remove those levies? Obviously, the argument is that the economic recovery prospects without those levies are not very are not very good, given the fact that we have hemorrhaged so much revenues during COVID. And this definitely is needed for the recouping of those monies. Is it possible to even consider that? And also the notion of let's say the cap, is that cap on fuel that was promised?
I mean, yeah,
is that feasible still at this point in time?
All right, so there's a duality here, two points of views that have to look. A, government's fiscal objectives. B, the private sector's ability to absorb the cost of fuel or any raises in the cost of fuel. And there are Mr. Lane right now. Let me explain what I mean. As I was saying earlier, government distorts the price of fuel by introducing taxes into the price, well, the overall price or retail price of fuel at the pump to the consumer, based on the fact that the demand for oil or demand, sorry, for not natural gas, for fuel at the pump, especially fuel at the pump, is inelastic. In other words, Bajans don't put down the cars at the slate of an increase or potential slate of an increase. And that's a very dire example. So it means then a government has relied on it as a very reliable means of revenue. Very reliable. It's a very often used product. And for long, forever, they've been introducing taxes and removing taxes. So government, therefore, depends on it a little more than they say. I actually have never seen a government that has been, and I don't want to really use this word, but for the emphasis of it, being totally honest about why it applies the taxes that it does apply. I never heard an answer that for me has satisfied me as a consumer. Before even being an economist. So, like, you know, the fact too that they introduced, they put the road tax on at the pump, I have never liked the rate that they do it at. I think it's too high, because I remember when, and I had anticipated this after hearing the rate that they were planning on introducing in 2018, and I said to myself, all right, road tax normally, I might be very well off with the numbers, but road tax in Barbados normally would net the government around $10 million, for argument's sake. And I remember fiscal year 2019 when the estimates, late 2019, it was either the budget or fiscal year 2020, when they were doing the estimates, I remembered that, no, actually it was the central bank report, late 2019. They were saying, well, we were taxed more than collected what it was expected to collect over what it had collected the year in front. And it was somewhere close to $20 million Bajan dollars. I thought to myself, well, shucks, that's too high a rate then. this should really reduce that rate. I mean, unless they need the additional $10 million. And again, I'm just throwing numbers up here, right? I don't really want to be nailed to the cross with the numbers, because I'm not referring to the evidence, but it's there in the central bank reports if you want to go deeper into it. And I was there thinking, well, shucks, it means then they need that additional $10 million to close that fiscal surplus, or to create that fiscal surplus that they're trying their best to create, which is evidently being done to help pay off IMF debt and help, you know, to stabilize government finances. I'm like, all right, if they're doing it for that reason, fine. But if it is that they're simply looking at the promotion of more efficient collection of taxes, then it should cost more to the public for that purpose. Now, one would argue, I can imagine Avinash Prasad and others arguing, well, hey, we don't really have cash to do the works, so we have to borrow, so we need to ensure there's enough coming through in real taxes and other levies to pay for the roads. I argue that's always been done. There are not more roads in Barbados than there have been 20 years ago, in fact. So 10 million seemed to be enough then. Maybe the argument is different. So I am one that says, if it is that you're saying that this is about collection, efficient collection, being able, being the case that everybody has to contribute towards road tax, and maybe that's part of the reason that it went up to 20 million, or maybe let's say an additional 5 million or more was collected because you got people who weren't paying before, because there's only really like 50 something thousand cars on the road anyhow, so, but anyways, so if that was the case, then, you know, cap that rate. That rate should have been capped before we had these recent price increases. So my issue is that it has been too late, but I welcome the cap. as a temporary measure. The government will still make its targets at the amount that it has set, right? It still will meet that target. It still will collect more than the 10 million, if you want to adjust for inflation, 12.5 to 13 million in real tax. They will, demand will not drop off that significantly for fuel in Barbados. It basically was almost the same. A little lower, people were driving less during the pandemic, but you know, the government still managed to collect. Or it could be that they thought it was too low during the pandemic and this is time to recoup. That was the first question there about the cap, but there was another thing you wanted me to ask.
Well, the cap I was referring to would have been also the cap on the VAT on the fuel. I
mean, oh, the cap on the VAT on fuel?
And that was promised. And also, yeah. If it is now too late to remove, is it going to make a difference now if they were to remove that fuel level? Can they do it? Or lower it.
Right, but how I would challenge, how I would look at that. Again, it was the cap on the road tax that was more interested in on the lowering of the rate. Capping the VAT also would be helpful. Again, it wouldn't necessarily, that's going to be a logistical nightmare. Now I think about it. If we had a tax there to look at, that's going to be a small bit of a nightmare in terms of the adjustment and being able to pay the refund that would be needed. But for me, the prime issue is the implementation. And the prime issue is that, you know, government needs to continue balancing this budget. And this tax is not the most significant. Again, I speak subject to a lot of correction here with respect to how much VAT is indirectly or directly collected through the use of fuel in Barbados. But that as a headline item is the most important revenue item. So it can be felt if you get tens of millions of dollars coming off of your VAT in terms of revenue collection. So it could in the long term, I don't imagine in the short term it will, really become a cause of concern to government's efforts to balance its budget, especially as the economy now is going into a low period. We're not in the midst of tourism where, you know, people are expected to come and show up for our balances, increase demand temporarily on the island, bring about foreign exchange that could help us in terms of the future purchase of oil. We're pretty much going into this low period. Crop over might be a good temporary relief. So for me, in the short run, I don't really see a big issue just yet. The issue is if this war escalates and prolongs, you know, and then government might not be able to make its targets on that end, and therefore it ties their hands as to what they may be willing to surrender without putting us even deeper into the arms of the IMF down the line. And that there is the cause for concern, given that COVID basically wrecked the fiscal budget that we have locally. People need to take that into consideration significantly when they look at what government tries to do and what taxes it may be willing to remove. It's painful. And I wish it could be different. And maybe somebody way smarter than me in the administration comes up with a solution that allows them to stagger, let's say, what they will cap and when they will cap it. You know, they have more information than I'm privy to daily. So it to me, is going to be tough in the midterm. And in that case, you know, if they had the caps on earlier, the price would not have gone over $4. But to be honest, though, Paul, there's a lot of pressure on that price. Like, for me, it should have been close to the 4.75, to be honest, given the amount of pressure that the government itself had to absorb during the pandemic. You have to take that into the consideration as well, that fuel never crept past $4.99 during the last 2 years. You had the protest by Olu Jimmy, and maybe that had something to do with it, but at the end of the day, it never crept past. So in my mind, I was always saying these guys are absorbing a lot of these price shocks that are happening globally. The price of oil just did not shoot up to over $100 overnight. It's been creeping up there during the pandemic. It's been creeping up there since 2018 in a sense.
You can contact your Nation Publishing subscription team 7 days a week in 7 different ways. Call customer service any day at 430-5550. Call subscriptions at 430-5503 or 04. Email subscribers@nationnews.com. Email epaper support@nationnews.com. visit www.nationnews.com and select print subscriptions. Visit www.nationnews.com and select e-paper subscriptions. Visit our office on Fontebelle, St. Michael. If your call is not answered, please leave a message. We are here to serve you. Nation News, your news, your time, your way.
Now, if you may switch gears a bit, we are looking also at other effects of the exogenous shocks and other products, not just petroleum products.
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Food as well, and so on. The whole notion, given the fact that we are expecting or anticipating some jumps in that regard, the notion of price control at this point. Do you think that
we should
uncover conversation.
All right, so I'm not a fan of price control, but I understand why people are calling out for it, and if I were to meet them halfway, they would have to be done in line with what I spoke to in terms of the caps I introduced periodically based on certain conditions. Look, the only things that make sense when it comes to price control, this is economics 101, this isn't even theory, this is applied across the world. There's too much anecdotal evidence, not even anecdotal, there's too much quantitative evidence out there that speaks against price controls, even for small open economies. And so there's only one type of product that makes sense when you attach price controls, and it's the same inelastic products that I spoke about with you. Right, the same inelastic one. It is easier to apply price control. The government of Barbados has been doing it for a while, and to its benefit, it's been successful for one reason or another, right? In terms of them being able to get taxes. Likewise, in terms of price controls, rent, believe it or not, especially in high density population areas, that's another product that comes to mind, or service that comes to mind. That benefits from price controls. Typically, when you have demand, when you have what you call elastic demand for a product, i.e., I can always switch to something else. Price controls, actually, the consumer will tend to want to benefit more, will benefit way more than the producer from that. The producer would realize, well, hey, I'm not, and this is me talking simply, what we need to advance economics. Hey, for something like this, I can't compete. This is not recovering my costs. I'm not able to recover my costs. I, for some reason or another, was pricing at X amount over my costs because maybe I had an expensive staff complement. Maybe I had a very expensive, staff complement. Maybe I had transportation costs that were too high. So the problem with price control is that ultimately, somebody bears the loss. And typically, price controls mean that the producer bears more, the producer, i.e. the retailer, will bear more of a loss than the consumers who stand in. And ultimately, producers never like to bear losses. So either it will come from it will result either in dumping of goods, which is the worst case scenario. And normally that happens, that there are cases of it happening in war-torn states that were now recovering. And then in the worst part, you get shortages, unless you force people to bring in stuff. And then people would opt not to invest capital in other places, either through the retention of jobs or either through investing in great infrastructure, psychosanitary health. Things start to basically decline on its side. And that's the sad part. Like if it was, again, an inelastic part where demand could not have been affected no matter the change in price controls typically work because already if you got inelastic demand, it means that your profits are pretty much certain, right? You can't dig into the profits more. You know, there's no way you could. But then again, it comes down to how low the price control is going to force you down, right?
Yeah.
So like, from that point of view, I don't like price controls long term because it means that the private sector, you're expecting the private sector to act in the national interest, which it did for 2 years. All right. There hasn't been a massive job loss. And yes, there were job losses. Don't get me wrong, but massive meaning that, you know, you were expecting on the tail end of the pandemic, probably the unemployment rate to be over 25%. It temporarily had went up into that region, and then it sort of stabilized as persons found their own means of employment as well. So that's to be applauded. But then you basically ask retailers for 2 years to hold strength. Now there's a war that nobody knows when it's going to end. Again, but it looks to be escalated slowly by the day, which is more dangerous than flat out war in terms of economic planning. At least I know if everybody's fighting with full scale guns, it will end sooner rather than later versus little instances of aggression, little comparatively, right? So then you're asking the private sector to commit to an uncertain future, uncertain end for more than that 2 years via the price control. No, I do not argue against the spirit of price control. I just think that when people make the argument for them, that they have to understand that it is not government alone. Government has to, as it did during the pandemic, seek the buy-in of the private sector. And that will have some very, very consequences, very dire consequences relating to how capital is invested in Barbados outside of just purchasing inventory and distributing it to the market. But you had asked again too about the other exogenous shocks. And just remember with respect to food prices, there's a Barbados is a one-way, I like to call Barbados a one-way dark hole when it comes to products. We don't export something similar to what we import. So in other words, we don't export low-cost food items. At best, high-cost food items, the likes of a few chocolates. Recently, the BIPC is looking to push breadfruit as a value-added, not just raw breadfruit, but chips and all that. So, you know, value-added stuff, but we don't have the scale going up. So it means like almost every container that comes into Barbados, there's an empty, containers don't really need, but there's an empty container that heads back up to the United States of America or wherever the ships are coming from, Panama or whatever. So it pretty much means that you pay for a long trip to begin with when you're importing food into Barbados, which already makes it expensive, more expensive than a place, let's say, of similar size. Jamaica, in terms of being a small open economy, is larger than we are. That at least exports some fragment of what is imported sensibly. You mean some containers go out, more come in, but they're able to have a better balance of effect than we do. And therefore, that helps along with the large size of its population to ensure prices for them for similar products are lower, and lower incomes as well that they have in Jamaica on average. So the problem here is that, you know, ships don't have sails. Those kind of ships don't have sails that send them across the ocean. They're powered by fuel. They're not powered by clean energy just yet. And as a result, if the price of oil and gas increases, then you know that it will affect the cost of shipping. And already we are more expensive to ship to, and we absorb more of a cost than other destinations nearby that have a better profile of products too, right? And we already have a high cost jurisdiction because of it. Electricity is more expensive here. Clearly the cost of transportation here is way more expensive than even in the Caribbean. They benefit somewhat from being a part of the Petro-Caribbean deal, although long term that's a big issue. That's another story for another thing. But the point remains that, you know, the fact that to get products here is more expensive than our near-term or our near-field compatriots in CARICOM and France, Martinique and Guadeloupe. We should expect an even more dire increase or shock to the cost of living if the price of oil gets out of control. Now, these shippers don't buy oil from us only. You know, they buy oil to get here. So, however they ship in the States, if they stop in Jamaica for a bit, wherever Jamaica gets its fuel from, that feeds into our export, our import costs. If they stop in the Dominican Republic to offload some goods, the price of oil or wherever they get that oil from, how the price is calculated, that's calculated into our imported and landed costs as well. So like, it's a complicated thing. And it means that you can't play with the price of oil, no matter where it goes, and we can't control it. We can try our best to plan for it. it will affect everything. Everything you touch will just jump up again on top of the jumps last year.
This is now the million-dollar question, and the question I wish we'd wrap up on. Obviously, much of this depends on how protracted this war is, how long it's going to last.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. On a war that lasts, that's protracted, build me a worst-case scenario for the economy. Now we are facing this crisis at this point. What is the outlook, as I said, within the context of a protracted war?
I don't want to paint the scenario where people starve and die. And by saying it, I pretty much put people's heads right now. There's been some, I guess, some ray of hope, in a sense, where the private sector globally has shown me that there's a bit of a spine when it comes to taking affirmative action against the war. That may present a headwind that Russia did not anticipate. Right, so maybe this thing doesn't last an entire year. I would hope, especially with every major company leaving Russia and how it affects and weakens their banking sector and whatnot. And yes, they're running over to China, but you know, it depends on what kind of long game China wishes to play in this regard. China has all the culprit in this sense. So let me put this to you. Worst case scenario to my mind then is that we deepen. We run back to the IMF for even more loans. And then what that means for us long term in terms of tight fiscal space going forward. We just had, on one hand, you know, a new distribution of SDRs last August and so. I want to put that in its own category in terms of relief. I don't really have to tell you my margin to explain it. But you know, for all intents and purposes, it means then we run back to the IMF or we run to China. We basically load up on our debt profile even further. Something that pretty much the Modi administration had tried its best to deal with as a campaign promise and had done fairly okay. I have my grosses with respect to the restructuring, and that's been documented. But, you know, evidently it puts us down one lane. You said worst case scenario. So, where ironically we run to even more debt relief, but the price of things become so far out of reach that even the debt relief might not be enough to sustain the lives of the most vulnerable in Barbados. It doesn't mean people starve and die. It just means that what we saw during the pandemic, it will be slightly worse in terms of access to different facilities. It could be certain shortages in terms of the price of transportation has gone up so high, or you can't really assess goods when you need them. Ironically, in a slightly different field, aviation, that's been happening already. The flying airplane parts is a headache right now versus last year, believe it or not. But the parts are there, it's just getting them to you is a whole other story. So, I see some, I don't want to say acute shortages, but definitely some very notable shortages of food items. I definitely see that government will have a very difficult time maintaining fiscal space the longer this goes. I see it even being more, especially if the war ends up being fought in ancillary airspaces, so not just Belarus, but near to Greece or even closer to Romania and whatnot, that there'll be shocks to the travel industry because they'll have more closures of airspaces. It'll become more complicated. The price of, travel will jump through the roof in line with the price of oil and the scarcity of routes. So that would affect our tourism product, which ironically means that the Barbados government needs to put more money to incentivize air travel to the region, to Barbados again. So like all in all, this just means that government has a very tight fiscal space, and as a result, the private sector would have issues as well in terms of maintaining prices, employment. But for me, how dire it gets depends on how many years the war goes on and how quickly it accelerates towards a full-blown escalation where maybe there's talk about using nuclear weaponry against Russia. Russia looking to actually use or to propose a threat of nuclear war on its own. That's it.
Jeremy, as always, a pleasure, and it's, you know, insightful as always, your comments. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to come and break down the facts to the public.
Thank you for the platform. Thank you, sir.
Now, there you have it, folks, from economist Jeremy Stevens, his take on the Ukraine crisis and how it can impact Barbados. And again, just to emphasize on his last point, that was a worst-case scenario. It wasn't a case where he's saying that this is something that is going to happen in the short term. This is what he's saying. If the war is protracted and lasts, you know, several years, that's the worst-case scenario. Just a plug there to ensure that forces don't run away with the wrong motion. So again, thank you again for joining us, and do have